This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. Anjali Njeti grew up here in Chattanooga, and on her website, she identifies as author, teacher, organizer. She reflects on her own multiracial and multiethnic identity and the evolving demographics of the South today as its non-white populations grow in her recent works, Southbound, a collection of essays, and The Parted Earth, her debut novel. Anjali spoke with us from her home in Johns Creek, Georgia, northeast of Atlanta. Anjali, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Ray, for having me. I really appreciate it.
You talk about how you are not from one South, but multiple Souths.
Well, first of all, I am Southern. I identify as Southern. I wasn't born in the South, but my family moved to Chattanooga when I was 10 years old. I graduated from GPS, and my parents lived in their Chattanooga home until 3 years ago. So I had a home base in Chattanooga. And of course, I've lived northeast of Atlanta for 14 years now. But my father is an Indian immigrant, and his family has their roots in Chennai and Hyderabad, which is in the southern part of India. And I also am very actively involved in the South Asian community here. So I also identify as South Asian.
You have roots that touch three continents.
I do. So obviously, North America and Asia. And my maternal grandmother and her family were Austrian. So I have connections to Europe. And actually, my maternal grandfather, he and his family were Puerto Rican, though, of course, that's obviously the same as North America. But they do have roots in New York City and in the island.
And how did growing up in Chattanooga shape you, shape your work as a writer and then later your work as a political activist?
I suppose Chattanooga is like any city in that it is a city full of contradictions. That, of course, can be found anywhere. But for me, I had moved down from a suburb of Detroit. At the time, Chattanooga did not have the racial and ethnic diversity in the early 1980s that it does now. It was still quite a bit segregated. I mean, this was 20 years after the passage of the Civil Rights Act. So it was a different place. And I found myself among a largely white evangelical Christian community, which was very different from my suburb of Detroit, where certainly it was not the epitome of diversity at the time either. But there were, you know, Black people, brown people, immigrants. There were people who were non-Christian. These were folks that I knew. And at the time in Chattanooga, there was the dearth of that. So I started feeling more acutely a sort of otherness in Chattanooga that I was not accustomed to in my Detroit suburb. And my activism, I think, is rooted in trying to understand this otherness, to what does it mean for me? What does it mean for a community that I am a part of, but also feel a little bit on the outside of? And what does it mean to sort of seek change in that state of being? What does it mean for anybody who feels otherness, whether it's racial otherness or gender and sexuality otherness, ability otherness? But what does it mean to feel on the outside of a community that you live among and you breathe in and that you celebrate your own family in?
As a mixed race person, as a mixed ethnicity person, growing up as the other in Chattanooga in the 1980s, you did not fall along where most people would automatically categorize you. Not Black, not white. That must have manifested itself in all kinds of ways. On the one hand, being treated as invisible, to on the other hand, this is an example of the model minority, as they call it.
Absolutely. You know, Ray, it's interesting when I think back. I mean, Chattanooga has changed so much. I started in Chattanooga at Harrison Elementary in my fifth grade year. I was literally the first brown person, the first non-black, non-white person that most of my classmates had ever seen. And my understanding now is that elementary school has a very large Latinx population, and in fact, is very non-white. But when I started, I was the first brown person anyone had seen. And then I started in sixth grade at Bright School, and I had several classmates there tell me that I was the first brown person that they'd ever seen. They could not figure out what I was. But, you know, what do you mean you're not black and you're not Indian? What they meant was Native American, right? So it was very confusing for a lot of people. And you're right, there were not really a large amount of mixed race people, or at least if they were, I certainly didn't know them. At the time, I knew two families that were mixed race Indian families. But as a result, I didn't even understand my own identity as being mixed. I couldn't kind of wrap my arms around it simply because it was so rare. I think I write in the book Southbound that I felt like I was some kind of unicorn, right? I wasn't, you know, the Indian community didn't even necessarily know what to do with us. It was a small, small community back then, and there weren't enough of us to form sort of our own community, and non-Indian communities didn't know what to do with us. So it was largely a feeling of being different and sort of seeking approval from a lot of people that didn't look like me and trying to fit in. I mean, it's a lovely thing to see now when I visit Chattanooga. It looks so different than when I grew up, which is such a beautiful thing to witness today.
And another thread in all of this is religion.
Yes, absolutely. You know, my mother is Catholic. We were raised Catholic. It's not a religion that really resonated with me much, even when I was a child. My father is Hindu. He's still a practicing Hindu today, and my mother is a practicing Catholic. It's interesting, even back then in the 80s, you know, evangelical Christianity was very popular. Most of my friends identified themselves as evangelical Christians, and so even being Catholic was a little bit odd. There weren't a whole lot of Catholic families almost 40 years ago. But yes, I was sort of between religions. I was frequently told by children that my father was going to hell and that I would go to hell as well if I believed in Hinduism, if I identified as Hinduism. And so I kept that part quieter in me. I sort of found myself distancing myself from my father because he was being condemned. And even my mother seemed strange with her Catholic religion. It was, you know, Protestantism was much more common. It was much more popular. So I didn't know how to hold these two faiths. I didn't know how to balance them or how to juggle them or whether that was even possible to balance or juggle them. And I didn't have many models to show me how to do so.
You had to create models for yourself along the way.
I did. In this sense, I think activism was largely a way for me to find my way out of the ambiguity and the confusion and feeling as if I didn't have the ability to define myself, that I was always sort of what others defined me as. And it was building community through activism, through various causes. You know, I first got involved in working to end intimate partner violence, which was called back then domestic violence. And then it was finding ways to support communities and educate them about sexual violence against women in particular. And then I was involved in issues like abortion rights. But whatever the cause was, I found it to be liberating to do that work. I found more people that hailed from backgrounds similar to my own. And the progressive movement, progressive causes, sort of are what called me home and helped me to shape who I was.
What are some of the themes that you try to convey in your collection, Southbound? Because the word Southbound can be read so many different ways. You're bound for the South. You're bound with the South. You are bound to the South and all the preconceptions and misconceptions thereof.
Absolutely. I mean, for me, bound has a positive connotation. I am, for better or for worse, I am a daughter of the South. So I embrace with it all of its problems and issues and all of its joys and love and celebrations. And I am also complicit in what I found fault with in the South, right? I upheld and supported white supremacy. I tried to embody whiteness. This, of course, is also wrong, right? I am just as much at fault here. And this is what I explore in Southbound, that I also was in the wrong. And so part of being Southern to me is acknowledging not only the past and the ways that we have viewed our histories, but also realizing that these harmful systems of oppression are very much alive in the present day. And part of the reason they still are is because many of us non-Black people, non-Indigenous people, have refused to reckon in the ways that we are complicit in them themselves. I mean, look, writing this book was very much that process of undoing the ways that I also contributed to the harm. And I still am today. Let that be known, that I am still not fully decolonized myself. Undoing white supremacy is a lifelong journey for people like me and for others who were born in it and raised in it and saw the value in it and thought that bettering ourselves was very much aligning ourselves with white supremacy.
And now you're getting at the complexities, not only along racial lines or ethnic lines, but even within those groups and subgroups.
Absolutely. Look, all marginalized groups, unfortunately, have a relationship to white supremacy and are perhaps not dismantling white supremacy in the ways that we should. I consider myself a member of the Asian community, of the South Asian community, of the Indian community. We have our own hierarchies. We have colorism that we deal with, meaning that we devalue people of darker color. We continue to have a caste system, despite the fact that it was legally abolished a while back. We still implement that ourselves in both obvious and more subtle ways. And historically, we have been anti-Black. And so we have a lot of our own bigotry and prejudices to root out ourselves. And the work is very much in acknowledging this, in coming to terms with this, in realizing that in order to join the fight, in order to join the multiracial, multi-ethnic, multi-faith progressive coalition in this country, it involves really looking in the mirror at ourselves deeper and seeing the ways in which we are at fault and that we have to root out this bigotry of ourselves in order to do this work most effectively.
How do you think your debut novel, The Parted Earth, tries to tell that story in a literary way?
Writing The Parted Earth and revising it, what I came to realize is how contemporary some of these issues were. In 1947, during the partition, we were dealing with colonialism, right? The British were finally quitting India. We were dealing with this surge of toxic nationalism, where suddenly nations were meant to be homes only of people of certain faiths, right? We had India, which was established in 1947 as a secular democratic nation, but unfortunately, it became known as the home for Hindus and Sikhs, right? The Hindu majority country. And Pakistan, which would be known as the Muslim majority country. And the bloodshed from that time period was rooted in this division, in this belief that you could only belong to one place and you had to abandon everything you loved about your previous homeland. But the book, The Parted Earth, is also very much about borders and how harmful our ideas about borders can be. I mean, look, borders are nothing more than political. In that respect, they are essentially fictitious. You know, the border in between India and Pakistan was literally a line drawn in the sand by a British lawyer who had never visited the subcontinent until then. So it sounds absurd, but really all borders are simply just lines drawn in the sand by people who are in power in and trying to wield power over marginalized communities. That's all they ever were. And so the parted earth, even though it is historical, and even though 40% of it does take place in the past, after colonization, when these two nations were formed, I felt that I was very much writing about the present day. We have these issues of nationalism, of extremism, of borders dividing and conquering people happening today all over the world, including in the United States.
And the novel crosses continents and crosses generations.
It does. 40% of the novel takes place during partition, and roughly 60% is elsewhere in different decades. The trauma of partition, the tragedy of partition, is very much felt today in the present day in the subcontinent, but also we have generations later who are living the histories and the memories of their ancestors. Some of them stayed in the subcontinent, but we have an enormous diaspora who took the stories of their great-grandparents and their grandparents and their parents and their aunt and uncles and brought them elsewhere. And they are the embodiment of this trauma, of this fractured land. And they are living with these stories today. And of course, many of them, like the main character in my novel, don't even realize they're living with the trauma of their ancestors because so many of these stories got lost.
Whichever way you turn, as you navigate these different stories within this debut novel, I hear echoes of this South, whether we're talking about nationalism, whether we're talking about sectarian violence, to use a word that is commonly associated with a story that happens outside the United States and not in the United States. And I'm thinking of the violence that took place near you in Atlanta not so long ago.
That's so true, Ray. I mean, look, we have a long storied history of what you have very aptly termed sectarian violence. It is deeply rooted in the United States, starting, of course, with the enslavement of Africans, the genocide of our indigenous people here. We have the Trail of Tears. We have a history of segregation and terrorism and lynching here in the Deep South. And then, of course, we have this continuing today. We have white nationalists displaying their power, destroying homes, communities through gentrification, through gun violence. We have, as you mentioned, the horrific mass shooting that took place in the Atlanta area a few months ago. And we have hate crimes today that don't see any sort of justice. Or if they do see justice, it is rare. And that justice rarely seems to deter any future hate against various minority groups here. So this is absolutely a contemporary problem. It's a present day issue, and it has very much gripped our country and our nation and is very reminiscent of our past as a country.
And yet with all that you are saying here and all that you have written here, you come back in the end to hope.
For me, hope, for me, peace is action. It is doing something about the problem that's before us. I'm an individual. I can only do so much. I reckon with that every day. But hope for me is not letting things stay the way they are. It is undoing systems of power. We all have it within ourselves to do so. You don't have to take some major action, but it is working locally within your community to have tough actions, tough conversations, and doing something active, whatever that looks like. Hope is showing up at a school board meeting and speaking your mind about the curriculum that's being taught. It is keeping track of what's happening in your city council. It is not only volunteering at a food kitchen, but actually reckoning with the fact that we even have food kitchens because people can't afford food. It is being outspoken and being fearless and joining with people that do the same work and finding a way to not rest until there is some progress on this front.
And for people who want to keep up on all that you write, all that you do. Where can they go online?
So I'm very active on Twitter. I spend way too much time on Twitter, and my handle is at Anjali and Jetty. So that's probably the best place to find me. My website is anjaliandjetty.com, and I'm also on Instagram on Anjali and Jetty. Do you see how I've made it easy for people? Truthfully, it's just about making it easy for me, since I can't seem to remember anything beyond my first and last name. So yes, I can be found online, and I'm always happy to meet people online and enter some of these tough conversations.
All right. Anjali, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Ray. Have a great day.
On Thursday, 15 restaurants in the Chattanooga area will help support the fight against HIV in the Tennessee Valley in this year's Dining Out for Life. Mitzi Ward is with Sempa Community Care. Mitzi, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us more about this year's Dining Out for Life.
It's actually an international program, Dining Out for Life International, and cities all over the United States host this event. And the monies raised help those living with HIV in our community. So even though it's an international event, it benefits this community. So all the money raised will benefit those living with HIV in our area. The money helps with food supplies. Such a big thing with any disease is nutrition and healthy eating. We have a market for our clients, and this money helps with that market. It helps with our case management to make sure that our clients stay on their medications and stay up to date with all their meds. It just helps all the different programs that help that individual live the best life that they possibly can.
How is it being held differently at this stage of the pandemic?
Well, much like last year, we, of course, are encouraging takeout. The majority of the restaurants are open now, though. Some have restrictions. Others don't have that many restrictions. But, you know, we are totally leaving that up to the patron. If you feel comfortable going to a restaurant, go to the restaurant. If you would be more comfortable ordering takeout, by all means, order takeout.
And where can people go online for more information about all the restaurants that are participating this year?
We have some awesome restaurants. We're so excited about all the restaurants. You could name off your favorite restaurant, and I would say it's on our list. Go to Sempa, C-E-M-P-A.org. Check us out. Check out your restaurants. Pick your favorite and join us that evening. Now, Southern Star will be open for lunch. It's our only one that's actually going to be serving lunch. So if you'd rather join us for lunch, come on over to Southern Star. Join us there. Otherwise, we've got an entire list of 15 restaurants that you can join us at that evening.
All right. Mitzi, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
This is Scenic Roots. The Isis Theater in Asheville has been streaming both virtual shows and, more recently, shows on the main stage in the music hall for a limited, socially distanced audience. At the same time, they are also now staging concerts on the lawn behind the theater. One recent concert on the lawn featured the singer and songwriter Dave Jordan with his band, the NIA, the Neighborhood Improvement Association. Dave Jordan has been making music in New Orleans for more than two decades, first as a bass player with the band called Juice for nearly a decade, and more recently he's been playing acoustic guitar and singing with the NIA. The NIA is Will Repholz on bass, David Shirley playing drums, Alex Mallett is the lead guitar player, and Rurik Newman is the violinist.
show. They're hitting you whenever you get here. Roll down your window. Listen to that river roll. And baby, you can act just like you don't care. We ain't got nothing, baby. If you got the waiting feel, the waiting feeling fine. I could barely walk a straight line. So full of doubt and second guessing, just trying to find ways to fill my time. I keep telling myself that I'm alright, that I'm doing fine, and maybe I've been lying to myself. To myself, and maybe I've been lying to myself. Well, your mail still comes to my front door. Well, you don't live here anymore. And there's a pain every time that I see your name, driving me insane. But it's something that I can't ignore. I keep telling myself that I'm alright, that I'm doing fine, and maybe I've been lying to myself. 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 Take it easy playing on my radio. I couldn't bring myself to sing along. I know you think it's easy come and it's easy go, but baby, no, no, no. Nothing stayed the same since you've been gone. And I keep telling myself that I'm alright, that I'm doing fine. Baby, I've been lying to myself. Baby, I've been lying to myself. Baby, I've been lying to myself. Well, I've been lying to myself.
All right, this is Dave Jordan of Neighborhood Improvement Association live at WWOZ New Orleans.
worry much and he don't lose his touch, cause he's getting on a neighbor. And he give a word he got, yeah, I got a neighbor. Yeah, drive a tow truck. Yeah, that's my neighbor. Yeah, that's mine. Man, I got a neighbor. Man, he's a doc. See, he got more money than anyone out of them, but he's a honest man and he does what he can by sharing his wealth, by keeping up our health. Yeah, I got a neighbor, man, he's a doctor, a funky doctor, they get funky.
Truck. Sailing on a different sea.
Dave Jordan and the NIA from a set in the studios of WWOZ in New Orleans in March of last year, and from the Funky Uncle, a club in New Orleans from last October. From listener-supported public radio in Chattanooga, this is Scenic Roots.